what better way to introduce us and welcome us to Hollywood than an actual Hollywood actor? I didn't realize when I met Scott Clifton in Kansas, I forget when that was, earlier this year or a year or two ago, we just met for breakfast, and he was giving a talk about free thought. And so Annie Laurie and I thought, well, let's have him on our radio show. So we had Scott Clifton on our radio show, and he has a podcast, which we couldn't say on the radio show. They wouldn't let us. We had to call it theoretical BS. But here we can call religion what it is, right? Theoretical bullshit is what it is. And then so I kind of said, well, it's nice to talk with you, Scott. So what do you do? You have a job? And he says, oh, yeah, I've got a job. I work. You know, what do you do? I work in TV. And I said, oh, good. What are you, like a camera? No, I'm one of the actors. Scott Clifton is an award-winning, Emmy award-winning Hollywood actor. And you may have seen him. He played a young Dylan Quartermain on ABC's General Hospital. He also played Skyler Joplin on ABC's One Life to Live. Or you might watch him today as Liam Cooper on CBS's The Bold and the Beautiful. He won Daytime Emmys in 2011 and in 2013. He's been on a lot of primetime television shows and hit shows, including Judging Amy, Undressed, I haven't seen that one, maybe he'll tell us about Undressed, and Roswell, and he's also appeared in a lot of movies. He began acting as a teenager and was first in commercials at the age of 16. He's going to turn 30 this week. He was born on Halloween. So we should say happy birthday to him, I guess. He's a lifelong atheist. He's a host of the Freethought YouTube blog called Theoretical BS. He tells us that his parents are non-pushy Buddhists. And sounds like California, doesn't it, Tim? But he was the only non-believing child in an evangelical neighborhood. He used to have a pet wolf whose name was Mist. His mother, you may have heard of her, Dr. Faye Snyder, is a psychologist who founded the Parenting and Relationship Counseling Foundation, or the PARC Foundation. And he says he was sometimes a guinea pig for his mother's psychological studies. She had a theory, the casual theory of parenting, basically a hands-off theory, to just trust the child with no authoritarian control. And I think Scott will be one evidence of how that kind of parenting turned out. He's also a singer and a songwriter. We played some of his music on Freethought Radio. But his YouTube video is the real love of his life. It's called Theoretical Bullshit. Maybe you didn't know he was like a famous actor. He just loves doing it. And he'll tell a little bit about why he named it that. He talks about theology, philosophy, morality. He debates William Lane Craig. He debates Matthew Slick and others. He's going to tell us a little bit about what it's like to be an atheist in Hollywood. So where is Scott? Where are you? Here he comes. He's not just a pretty face. He's got a beautiful mind.
Hi. That was such a nice introduction. Oh my God. I don't know. Thank you so much for having me here. This is such a treat. Like you heard, my name is Scott. I'm an actor on a soap opera. I'm on The Bold and the Beautiful now. I've been doing soap operas for about 12 years, and as you also heard, I'm an atheist. Moreover, I'm an atheist who spends a lot of time criticizing religion, so that's kind of a weird combo, but there you have it. I got to sit and I got to see like how many of you are from out of town and how many of you are from here. A lot of you are from here. For those of you who are not, I want to welcome you to my neck of the woods. Los Angeles isn't just where I live, it's where I'm from. And so I know a little something about what it's like to grow up in a predominantly secular liberal community. This is what's funny, because when Dan asked if I would do a talk about being an atheist actor in Hollywood, as complimented as I was, I was also kind of apprehensive, because the truth is, being an atheist actor in Hollywood is not like much. I really didn't think I could fill, like, you know, 25, 30 minutes talking about how easy and controversy-free it's been for me. So, because that's, you know, that's the criticism that Hollywood gets, right? You know, godless liberals running the entertainment industry. I'm not exactly a fish out of water here. I've always been an atheist, depending on how you use that word. And that's something kind of interesting about me being here because, you know, this is the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and for me, there was never a religion from which I was freed. But there is a reason that I take religion and its implications so seriously, and that is because a significant chunk of my life was spent as the only non-believer in a community of believers, and that gave me a perspective that I'm very grateful for. So I'm going to give you a little background on that, on me, before the Q&A stuff, I suppose. I was raised in a very secular household, but a very philosophical household. Dan mentioned that I had said before that my parents were non-pushy Buddhists. Even my parents were very apprehensive about describing themselves as Buddhists. We had a lot of books on like Zen and Eastern philosophy in the house growing up. And that was really influential, I think, in my thinking. The critical thinking stuff. My parents had no interest in religion, but they were interested in critical thinking. They were interested in deep, sort of philosophical questions. And of course, this is just a happy accident of my birth. I mean, because there's really nothing about being non-religious that guarantees an emphasis on critical thinking or philosophical thought. This is just the family I was lucky enough to be born into, like so many of us. And so I wasn't ignorant of religion. My mom thought it was fun to take me to different religious services, you know, Catholic and Jewish and Buddhist, and just for the experience of it. That kind of gave me like a bird's eye view of the world religions. And of course I played with some other children who had the religious programming running on the hard drive. If you're good, you go to heaven with God when you die, you know, and so forth. But my understanding at the time, you know, as a six, seven-year-old, was that this was just a kind of silly, lazy thing that some parents tell their children because they didn't want to have to talk to them about death. And, you know, I had lots of conversations with my parents about death, so I didn't really get that. I just thought things like heaven and hell and angels and prayer were in the same general category as Santa and the Tooth Fairy and the Boogeyman. I thought it was, oh, dear God. Sorry. I thought that was something that everybody grows out of. It wasn't until I was around 8 or 9 that I got the full picture. In 1994, some of you know what I'm talking about, there was a major earthquake where we lived, and we lived in this tiny little, you know, $300 a month rent shack, basically, and it took a lot of damage during the earthquake, so we moved. And the town we moved to happened to be very religious. It was a very isolated community made up of mostly evangelical Christians. It's still Southern California, you know, but there are definitely pockets of religiosity out here, as many of you know, and you know them when you see them. So now everything's different, right? And I'm going through this huge culture shock, even though I'm like 40 minutes away. And for the first time in my life, I'm realizing that people really believe this stuff. It is 100% true. It is unequivocally true to them. It's obvious that it's true to them. And they don't grow out of it. They keep believing it until they die. And suddenly, I'm the one with the silly worldview that my godless parents indoctrinated me with. And so all my friends, and especially their parents, that was a bigger thing. My new friends' parents were genuinely horrified that I wasn't going to church every Sunday. And I sort of became a practice dummy for Christian apologetics. And, you know, of course, I'm being given like piles, I'm not kidding, piles of Bibles. Like, I'm not sure what the logic is behind that. Like, the more Bibles you own, the more convincing it becomes. I don't know what, you know, and I'm being given copies of The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel and Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell, and I'm being pressured to account for things like, how could the universe exist if God didn't create it? And how could the human body be so complex if God didn't design it? And how come there are monkeys if evolution says that we came from monkeys? And, I'm like 9 years old. I did not have answers to any of these questions. Because naturalism was something that I didn't use that word then, but naturalism was something I took for granted. I didn't ever think that I would have to defend science as a practice. And it was this frustration, it was this feeling of helplessness that really did it for me. I became highly motivated to learn everything I could about this religion. So I knew what it was I didn't believe and knew why it was I didn't believe it. I read the Bible, I read the books they were giving me, I went to church with them, I went to youth group with my friends, I went to Christian camp with them, I had a lot of questions with preachers and pastors and church elders, and I probably asked what were annoying questions, but they were game for it because you got to think, from their point of view, it could lead to my salvation, so why not? Actually, come to think of it, I wonder if this is like the inverse experience of people who leave, like kids who leave their deeply evangelical hometowns and then go to secular college, and suddenly they're bombarded with these challenges to their religious beliefs. And I wonder if that highly motivates them to take up the apologetic game. The big difference is that, for me, this process started like long before college, and so I had the luxury of using my adolescence to figure this shit out. One day, when I was around 12 or 13, I was in a Barnes & Noble bookshop, it was a school project, and I wandered into the religion section, and I found this book by a guy named Dan Barker called Losing Faith in Faith. And this, let me tell you, I'm not kidding, this book was a game changer for me because I realized that there was a whole other side to the story. It wasn't just about understanding Christianity and knowing why I wasn't buying what they were selling anymore. Suddenly, I was seeing right in front of me these informed, compelling arguments against these claims presented by someone who had once believed them and even preached them as fervently as the people I was now dealing with. I felt sane, finally. It was funny, I was sitting in class one time, we had like an open period, and I was reading this book in class, and there was a kid sitting next to me, and he like looks over and he goes, "Well, what are you reading?" And I said, "Oh, it's this book, it's called Losing Faith in Faith. It's by this guy who's like a minister, and now he's an atheist, and it's like about why he stopped believing." And before I could even finish the sentence, the kid's like, "Lies!" That's literally what he said. That's verbatim. This is ingrained in my memory. And I went, "What do you mean? What's lies?" And he goes, "It's all lies." And I said, "Well, I'm not getting what you're. Are you saying that it's a lie that he's an atheist, or it's a lie that he was a minister, or it's a lie?" It was so interesting that he didn't recognize a distinction between thoughtful criticism and straight up dishonesty. I thought that was an interesting moment for me. By the way, I am not like conveniently rewriting history just because I'm here talking to you guys. Dan's book really was the first open criticism of religion that I had ever read, and I largely credit him and the Freedom From Religion Foundation for my entire philosophical trajectory. Thank you guys. So I started getting into debating. I started actively seeking out, I'm still a kid, but I'm actively seeking out conversations with people who A, disagreed with me, and B, were a lot smarter than me, than I. See, right there, that's an example. Shoot, my mom would be so pissed. And I'm having these conversations and I'm getting my ass handed to me and I'm leaving with my tail between my legs, and then I have to do a sort of post-mortem about the conversation. I figure out where I went wrong and what I should say next time, and then I come to the next conversation stronger and smarter, and that was just kind of how it went. In the meantime, I was a terrible student in school. I spent a whole lot of my mental energy just fantasizing about how I could escape school. Despite my newfound fascination with philosophy and religion, I knew I wasn't going to do anything academic with my life. I wanted to be an actor. I mean, that was my passion. That's what I always wanted to do. I wanted to be an actor so badly that, ironically, I failed my high school drama class because I kept ditching to go to real auditions for real jobs. So eventually, I convinced my parents to let me take the test and get my diploma, and then I could drop out, so I could audition full time. And it was right after I turned 18 that I landed my first major role on a soap opera. It was called General Hospital, which was awesome because, among other things, it allowed me to pack up my shit and move back to the sweet-smelling, godless city of my childhood. And that, let me tell you, that was when I learned the hard way that there are ideologies out there that are infinitely more frustrating than any monotheistic religion. So if you're not familiar, I'd like to welcome you to the land of astrology, of numerology, of Scientology, the secret, what the bleep do we know, energy crystals, tarot cards, palm reading, past lives, new age spirituality, cosmic consciousness, and generally like the outright rejection of critical thinking as even a good or useful intellectual tool. Of course, I'm generalizing. Obviously, there are many, many exceptions to this. There are many, many smart and thoughtful and critical people in La La Land. I'm serious, you would not believe the number of respected acting classes out here where part of the curriculum is to send positive vibes out into the universe so that casting directors want to give us jobs. I mean, it's amazing. In Los Angeles, when somebody tells you that they aren't religious but spiritual, that almost always means they just believe a whole bunch of metaphysical stuff without evidence because it feels good. And it is perceived as incredibly offensive and insensitive to question or criticize that, because the thing is, it's not merely that everyone should be entitled to their own beliefs out here. What you hear a lot is that everyone is entitled to their own truth. So, you know, like if you believe in God and I don't, well, that's cool, man. You know, whatever. Like, God does exist for you and your reality, and he doesn't exist for mine. You want some of this? You can imagine, after a few years of this, I actually started to long for the kinds of conversations I used to have with fundamentalist Christians, because I'm serious, because at least we're both battling on the same hill. You know what I mean? At least we're both operating from the foundation that one of us is wrong. At least we both agree that there are correct and incorrect answers to big questions about the cosmos. And this is why YouTube, oh, I worship YouTube. YouTube is my saving grace, no pun intended. Because at the time I sort of dismissed YouTube as just a place where people post clips of like skateboarders hitting their nuts on rails and funny cat videos. Don't get me wrong, there is nothing wrong with cat videos. I think cat videos are the pillar of any civilized society. But it was so much more than that. I mean, here was this online community of people representing a wide spectrum of different views, and they're craving the same kind of dialogue I was, and they're having a great kind of point-counterpoint conversation by way of video responses to one another. YouTube has since gotten rid of the video response function, which is heartbreaking, by the way. I think we should all write letters. Sorry. And all it took was one time. I stumbled upon one video of this Christian guy pointing a camcorder at himself, and he was wanting to hear from atheists about how they could account for morality in a godless universe. And I thought, oh my God, I have an answer for this. And so I created an account, and that was my first YouTube video. I went with the name, as you heard, Theoretical Bullshit, because there was one time that I was arguing with somebody, and I tried to present a sort of hypothetical thought experiment kind of scenario to prove a point, and the response was, oh, come on, that's just a bunch of theoretical bullshit, and you know it. And I was just so tickled by that, I loved it. So I adopted it as my email address, and then eventually my YouTube handle. Anyway, that first video I made, to my surprise, ended up being pretty popular. It got me like a couple hundred subscribers, and things just sort of snowballed from there, and I started making more videos. But In doing so, keep in mind, I'm an actor at this point. Like I'm on a soap opera, and so here I am publicly challenging people's most cherished religious beliefs. And while I never mentioned that my day job was acting on a soap opera, people started catching on, and those two worlds kind of started bleeding into one another, which made me very, very nervous. But the truth is, I've received nothing but respect and admiration and support from my bosses and the people I work with. Like a couple of weeks ago, my boss comes up to me and he's like, "Hey, I really like this one YouTube video you did about how Christianity sucks." And I was like, I don't remember saying Christianity sucks. I don't think that was. This is something I've really come to appreciate about the Hollywood culture. You tell any story you want. You make any point you want about any subject you want, but for the love of God, be entertaining. So I'm boring myself to death hearing myself talk. Dan and Annie Laurie had suggested that it might be fun for me to play you guys one of my YouTube videos, and so in the interest of stalling and laziness, that's I'm going to conclude with that. If you've seen this before, I'm so sorry. This is actually one of my more popular videos. It's called "What If I'm Wrong?" And that was a question that I was asked a lot growing up, especially by my peers in high school. And I think this is actually a good question. I think this is a fair question. It's got a kind of Pascal's Wager vibe to it, but it's always asked earnestly, and I think it deserves a thoughtful response. One time I saw Richard Dawkins on a stage doing a Q&A, and he was asked that question, and it struck me how dismissive and defensive he seemed about it. He tried to turn it around on the questioner, and he said, "Well, what if you're wrong about Zeus?" And I didn't want to do that. So this is me trying to take this question as seriously as I can, and this is my best attempt. Okay, so I die, right? And much to my surprise, I find myself standing before the God of Christianity. What do I do? How do I feel about this? What would I think? What should I say? What if I'm wrong? And when I think about this question, I think about the fact that there are two very interesting characteristics that have always been attributed to this God. One is omnibenevolence, optimal love, optimal compassion, optimal mercy, optimal concern for the well-being of others. And the other is omniscience, knowing everything that could possibly be known about anything from any point of view at any time in any context. And one inescapable conclusion that follows from this is that if this being exists, it knows me. I mean, really knows me, understands me as well as I can possibly be understood. This is not a mystery. He is not sitting up in heaven racking his brain trying to figure out why Scott can't seem to believe in him. This God would be acutely aware of my history, of the causal chain of events and experiences that cumulatively contributed to the development of my entire personality and psyche and outlook on life. This being would understand impeccably that I am nothing more and nothing less than a product of that which I've experienced. Every interaction that I've ever had that changed me or forced me to think differently, down to the exact moment in my life which caused me to care about philosophy and religion and theology and the afterlife. This being would have a perfect appreciation for that. God would understand intimately my reasoning and my thought process and how I arrived at the conclusions I did. Even if Christians don't, he would know my views on morality and ethics and understand specifically why I think it more virtuous to approach religious claims critically and prudently than to accept them at face value on faith. He would understand why I think that I've lived a good life, why I think that I've made good choices, even if Christians don't. He would be aware of all the actions and all the characteristics that I've seen attributed to him by Christians, as well as Scripture, and why those actions and characteristics seem undeniably incompatible to me, not just with one another, but with the observable world. He would know about the time in my life when I actually picked up a Bible and made it a point to read the whole thing, and he would know the hundreds of verses I came upon which
which I found horrifying or absurd or completely incompatible with the notion that this was inspired by a just and loving being concerned with ensuring our salvation. Even if Christians don't. So if I found myself standing before this being, it goes without saying that my immediate reaction would be one of complete shock, complete and utter shock. I would be absolutely floored if I found out with certainty that the Christian God specifically exists. And the first question, the first thought that would even enter into my mind, I know, would be, what was wrong with my reasoning? I would beg, I would plead, regardless of whether I was on my way to heaven or hell, just to know what the flaw was in my thinking, where along the way were the mistakes I made that led me to the wrong conclusion. I would give anything to know that. I would give anything to know the answers. And of course, this God would know all too well, I took truth very seriously in my life. I never believed anything simply because I wanted it to be true or because I thought it would be beneficial in some way to assume it was true. And likewise, I never doubted any claim simply because I preferred it not to be true. But I would take comfort in knowing that the being responsible for judging me, for evaluating me, and ultimately deciding my fate, knows me so perfectly that I don't have to make any excuses for myself. The omniscience of this being would allow me to feel perfectly represented. I don't have to plead a case. I don't have to persuade anyone that my intentions were pure. These things are already known to this being. It would be known that I never doubted God's existence out of rebellion or spite or disregard for authority. It would be known that I'd have preferred the existence of a loving God all along and would have had no problem obeying the commands of this loving God. But I just found too many problems inherent in the concept. Too many contradictions, too many holes, too many propositions that require special pleading or circular reasoning or ad hoc speculation, and that I simply didn't observe anything about reality that couldn't have been the result of natural cumulative processes. It would be known that my cognitive faculties do not allow me to choose what I am and am not convinced is true about reality, that my disbelief is an involuntary reaction to what I perceived as a deficit of evidence for God's existence. And most importantly, it would be known that I thought it insufficient and even immoral to pretend that I believed in this being simply because I feared punishment or sought reward. And when I take into consideration what follows naturally from the knowledge attributed to this being, and I combine that with what follows naturally from the compassion attributed to this being, it's difficult for me to conceive that this being wouldn't be, in some sense, proud of me and pleased with the way that I've employed the intellect and the moral sense with which he would have endowed me, even if it turned out that I was wrong. I have a hard time imagining that this God would be offended by me and my thought process. Offended enough to allow for me to endure unbearable torment for all of eternity, and not as a form of discipline or correction or redemption, since it never ends. There's nothing constructive about hell. You don't come out of hell a better person. You don't come out at all. And so the only reason for the existence of such a thing would be vengeance. Of course, according to the Bible and according to most Christians, hell is exactly where I'm headed. No matter the life I lead, the choices I make, the intentions that I have, if I don't at least think that a God exists, well, sucks for me. And in the meantime, you know, extreme rapists and murderers and child molesters are welcomed into heaven with open arms so long as they accepted Jesus Christ as their personal savior before their demise. And if it turns out that this is the case, and that's okay too, because I don't know how I would be able to handle spending eternity alongside a being whose idea of compassion and fairness makes me sick to my stomach, a being whose empathy would be so easily trumped by his vanity. So that's my answer. Good thing I'm not wrong.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I don't know what happens now. I'm told I do a Q&A after this, but I don't know how that works. So I'm just gonna wait up here until somebody tells me what to do. I'm a follower, not a leader.
Was it my turn?
Oh, hey, hi, hi, how are you?
I'm okay. What, in your opinion, is the biggest drawback to Christian doctrine? Biggest ever, let's say.
Boy, that's a lot. I have a real problem with the emphasis on belief over behavior. I have a real problem with the idea of thought crimes. I think the notion that morality can be somehow divorced from the actual experiences that humans and other species are capable of having consciously is ridiculous. I don't think you can separate ethics from issues of suffering and happiness and well-being and make it about something like homosexuality or lust or what belief you have. The idea that can inform your eternal destination is really, really problematic to me. Thank you. Hi.
I'm curious, in Hollywood, I've been really enjoying the last few years reading some of the wonderful books, some of the exposés and YouTube exposés on Scientology. How much of an influence do they really have in Hollywood? And I know they sort of treat them like rock stars and so forth, but and do you ever run into that as a roadblock for anything?
Okay, that's a great question. Here's the thing about Scientology. There are a lot more Scientologists in Los Angeles and the Hollywood scene than you would know. I think in recent years it's become apparent to the church that they're getting a bit of a bad rap, and they're learning they're learning to isolate themselves maybe a little better. They've always had an MO of isolation. That's the most interesting thing about Scientology is that, you know, and you walk around here in LA and there's Scientology centers everywhere, and there's a lot of the time booths will be set up on the street and people will say, hey, come over and take a stress test or take, you know, hold on to this e-meter and we'll tell, you know, and they start talking about it, pitching you as if it's just kind of thing. But the thing about Scientology is that you don't get to know what your religion teaches until you put in the work, and by work I mean lots and lots of money. So it would be as if if Christianity worked the way that Scientology did. Like, when you first convert to Christianity, you get to know that there's a God. And then maybe if you work really, really hard and you donate a whole lot to the church, you get another little tidbit, which is that God actually impregnated a woman around the BCAD changeover. And then if you work a little harder and you donate a little more money, then you get to know that this son actually grew up to be a carpenter and he died on this cross. And then if you work a little harder and you donate a little more money, and so it works like that. And so a lot of the time you have... In Scientology, they divide it in terms of like OT levels. That's operating Thetan. I think the highest is like 8, and that's where like Tom Cruise is. What's interesting is if you get a chance to have, and I have had a very rare, very lucky occasion to have a real conversation with a Scientologist at a relatively low level, and because they are taught not to look on the internet and not to read, they're not allowed to read the criticisms of Scientology, they don't know what they're about to learn about. So if you mention like Xenu, they look at you like you're being ridiculous because they haven't gotten there yet. That hasn't been revealed to them yet, and they're not allowed to research it on their own. So it's a lot more prevalent than it might seem. And I think that's because there's a huge, huge isolation ethic there.
Okay, thank you.
I hope that answered your question.
Hi.
Hi.
I really appreciate your talk, Scott. And
thanks.
One thing I was really glad you brought up was that whole area of being motivated to be an out atheist. I've been an atheist a long time. I'm about 70, and something happened to me in my early life which motivated me to realize, to look into religion, even though I was a secular Jew, and the two words in my family that never were spoken were God or Jesus. They were never spoken. It's just, this is what we do, and this is what we do. We don't talk about it. There's no question.
Yeah.
And my mother was sick, and I was bar mitzvahed, and I was praying, and then she committed suicide, and then I had a lot of questions. And so over time, I eventually moved from Michigan to California because I couldn't be a good Jewish boy. I couldn't do it. So now I have three children who are in their 30s, and they know their dad's an atheist, and they're atheists, and my wife's an atheist, but none of them want to come here. I have tons of friends. One is an active atheist.
Yeah.
So that's the whole thing for me. It's like, well, you're so isolated. So it's so great to be here in a room full of people that are like-minded.
Yeah.
So comment on that whole thing of the reluctance of people who are atheists but will never say, I'm an atheist. Thank you.
Okay, can I ask you to clarify your question? Are you talking about people who are an atheist that don't, acknowledge...
People say, well, I don't really think there's a God. Or, yeah, you're probably right. But I don't want to declare that I'm an atheist. I don't want other people to think of me as an atheist. I'd much rather think, oh, I'm an atheist,
sure,
but I don't say it.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. I think that there's some... When you have a movement like... The one that is being propagated by, you know, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, any time you get into a human rights issue, the minority does have to get a little nasty because they don't get the attention if they don't get nasty. It happened with African Americans, it happened with gays, that's the way it works. And so there is if you are willing to take up that cross, there's going to be a stigma. And so it's not everyone who doesn't believe in religion or God, it's not everyone's job to pick that fight. And I think it's okay for some of us to be the aggressors and the controversial ones, and I think that there are others of us who are better at being the diplomats, because make no mistake, you need both. Mm-hmm. I think that's important. I think for a lot of us, we live in a community. I'll wrap up.
Sorry. One more quick question from Mark.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Hey.
Hi, Scott. You are awesome.
Thanks.
I discovered your YouTube channel several months ago.
Oh, cool.
And I'm just totally blown away. I want to compliment you on your use of what I call if, blah, then blip arguments.
Uh-huh.
And you're just taking the Christians at face value that, well, if God knows everything, why would I plead my case in judgment? He already knows what I'm going to say. And I just want to applaud you and keep on doing what you're doing. Your theology is deeper than a lot of theologians. And you really do cut through the BS. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's so cool. Thank you, guys. This was so fun.